Today's Taisho will be on case 100 in the Pi Yan Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 100 is entitled Hario's Sword Against Which a Hair is Blown. Engo's introduction: we sow the cause and reap the results. Starting carefully, we end in consummate perfection. From the outset, nothing was kept secret. When I talked, I had nothing to give you. Some of you will say to me, you have talked so much during the summer retreat, and now you say that from the beginning you had nothing to say. What do you mean? I reply that I will tell you when you have attained realization. Now, I ask you, is this simply because I do not fail to observe the first principle? Or is there some real advantage in doing so? See the following. Main subject. A monk asked Hario, what is the sword against which a hair is blown? Hario said, each branch of the corals embraces the bright moon. Secho's verse. To cut off discontent, rough methods may be best. Now they slap, now they point. The sword lies across the sky. Snow glistens in its light. No one can forge or sharpen it. Each branch of the coral embraces the bright moon. Marvelous. I want to thank everybody for coming to practice Zen this morning, and many of you arrived at 7, and many of you arrived at 8, and so some of you have been sitting for half the day, and those of you who came at 9:30 also sitting very deeply, and I'm so grateful to you for being here. This kind of collective practice is really priceless. And everybody is making an excellent, excellent effort. So thank you. So this is the last koan in the Blue Rock collection. The sword against which a hair is blown means there is a proverbial sword, like a samurai sword or a Chinese sword, which is so sharp that if a hair falls out of your head and floats down onto the sword will cut it right in two. You know, so it's so sharp that a hair drifting down will hit that blade and just be cut in two. Okay. So that's the first part of this koan. There's the preamble is important to know about too. Engo says, we sow the cause and reap the results. Starting carefully, we end in consummate perfection. Basically, the first principle of Zen is you can only wake up through your own efforts, basically. Okay, so. So basically, Engo is saying, you know, I've been teaching the Dharma all summer at our summer Ango, our summer retreat. And I've been talking day and night. And now I tell you, nothing can be said. And you already have all the information you need. Have I violated the first principle of Zen or not, that only you can wake up? For yourself. So that's what this is all about. So this is a wonderful koan because it's really about, rethinking who we are. You know, we have an image of ourselves, especially in the Western world, I would say. We have an image of ourselves that's really a very false image. And it's actually very crippling image of ourselves. I actually think that Engo in his introduction is sort of encouraging us to adopt that view of ourselves. I guess you could say we have what you could call the Humpty Dumpty theory of the self. So I don't know if everybody is familiar with this, but in the United States and probably in most of the English-speaking world, when we're children, we recite a nursery rhyme that goes like this: Humpty Dumpty sat on the wall. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. The king and all of his men, something like that. All the soldiers and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty together again. I guess that's it. So Humpty Dumpty sat on the wall. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. Something the king and all of his men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty together again. Okay. So I should have researched that before the Tay Show. But this is a view of the self as coherent and fragile, right? So, basically Humpty Dumpty is represented in children's nursery rhymes as an egg. And often he has a crown on his head, like he's the king. And he has a little shirt and little shoes. And, he leans too far over. He sat on a wall and he leaned too far over and he falls off and he breaks. And once he's broken, he's irretrievably broken. And he can't be put together even by all the king's men, right? Which is a lot of people trying to put it together again. So this is something we recite as children or used to. I don't know if children still do. But it's a lesson in how to understand yourself, right? So we're a we're a thing. We're coherent. We're unified. We have what you could call integrity, right? Integrity. So when we want to speak well of somebody, we say he has integrity. And integrity means basically that you're solid, you're unified, right? And that you're not dispersed, right? Or broken into a thousand pieces, right? So if we say he lacks integrity, we mean somewhat he lacks moral character, but it's a particular criticism. We're saying, he's not coherent. He's not solid. You can't rely on him, right? So we have this idea of the self as Humpty Dumpty. And, the lesson that little children learn from the Humpty Dumpty story is that if you lean over too far, it's dangerous and you can fall. And if you fall and break into 100 or 1,000 little pieces, you're irreparably damaged and you can't be reintegrated. You lose your integrity. So, I very much hope, if they haven't already retired the Humpty Dumpty nursery rhyme, that they retire the Humpty Dumpty nursery rhyme, because it's so misleading and it feeds into so many assumptions about who we are that are false. And it leads to, we're constantly trying to protect ourselves from falling and falling into 1,000 pieces. So, that's a dangerous myth, actually, dangerous children's story. It misleads us in every possible way. I would say it misleads children in every possible way about who they really are. I think a better way of thinking about it is like this. I was just reading something again by the great Persian poet Rumi. And Rumi says, he says in this translation, it was the womb, your wounds let the light in. And it could also be translated as the cracks in your life let the light in, right? So basically Rumi's against the Humpty Dumpty theory of the self, you know, which says once you can break into irreparable number of pieces, and then you've lost your integrity. And, you know, Rumi, who's a very profound person, says, wait a minute, you know, actually, when we break a little bit, it lets the light in, see? And I think that's a very deep, I think that's a very profound insight. You know, so, you know, actually losing our integrity, our coherence, somehow, Rumi says, lets the light in. And I love that poem, and I think it's much closer to the truth. You know, I remember that, you know, when I used to, when I started sitting with my teacher, Genki Takabayashi, Genki Roshi, I was so in awe of him. You know, first of all, I had read a lot of books on Zen. And I had formed a very exalted image of Zen teachers as enlightened beings. And when I met Genki Roshi, I was quite convinced that he was a deeply enlightened person. And he was, you know. He was just what he seemed to be in so many ways. And I became his student, and I began to practice with him. And his presence was really transformative for me. His example and his presence were really transformative. You know, we would go every morning to Kugeyan, which was our Zen center at that time. And we would get there at 5:30 in the morning, and Genki Roshi would throw open the windows, you know, and the Zendo would be freezing. And I would sit there, and I would usually sit like just diagonal to him. I could see him. And Genki Roshi would sit for an hour and a half and not move a muscle, right? And then he would get off the cushion, and we would have, somebody would be appointed to make breakfast, and we would make breakfast. And, you know, Genki Roshi would sit down and eat his breakfast. And there was just something about the way he sat, that his stillness, it was like a palpable stillness, right? And, you know, when I was around him, I felt safe and happy. And, you know, I would do Dokusan with him, and, you know, he would cut through so many of my illusions. You know, I would be in such emotional distress, and he would say something that would just cut through. And I realized, oh, I don't have to worry about this. So anyway, the more I got to know Genki, the more I was convinced that he was the teacher, you know, that I was looking for. But I also began to become afraid of Genki, right? I became afraid of Genki because I didn't want Genki Roshi to see who I really was. I don't know if this makes any sense, but, you know, when I was with Genki, I was a good Zen student. And when I was away from Genki, I was my old self, if this is making any sense. You know. When I was around Genki, I sort of kept my anger and my cynicism out of the picture, right? You know, and I was sort of like my most childlike self, my most trusting and childlike self. And when I was away from Genki Roshi and I was in my normal orbit, I was my regular smart alecky, cynical self and somewhat angry person. So I kept those apart. And you know, I was on my best behavior, sort of like I was walking on eggshells when I was around Genki, sort of unconsciously. I didn't make a decision to try to show him my best self. But, you know, I was trying to be my best self around him, trying to be like him, and I didn't want him to see, you know, I have some ugly things inside of me, you know, actually. I have some ugly things, you know. And so I didn't show those to him, you know, so my relationship with him was a little contrived, you could say. And I remember I was walking down the street one day in Seattle, and I was coming from my graduate classes. And when I was a young man, one of the things I used to do was when I would be walking down the street, I would be looking at beautiful women. And that was exciting for me. You know, I'd walk down, I was 22 years old. I was walking down the street, you know, there were all these beautiful women on University Avenue. And I would look at them and my heart would beat. And I would be sort of like in a little trance, you know. So, and then I'd go home and do my studies, you know. But anyway, I was walking down the street and looking at all the beautiful women, and who should be coming the other direction but Genki Roshi. And it was like, oh my God, I can't let him see me like this, you know, in my vacillating between lust and cynicism and anger and possessiveness and deceit, right? Because I was also married, right? So I actually, as he was coming up the street, I actually jumped in the door of a store and watched him walk by like, oh my God, that was a close one, right? You know? So, you know, I escaped Genki Roshi on that occasion. And I was able to sort of like preserve this relationship that was sort of based on a lie I was telling myself and a false image I was projecting to my teacher, you know, which is totally normal because we don't really know who we are, right? I mean, actually, we're doing this all the time. We're constantly becoming the people other people want us to be. That's part of what it means to be a human being. And, you know, we're locking ourselves into these images of ourselves all the time, right? You know, I wanted to be a good person. I wanted to be like Genki. You know, and so anyway, I remember Genki Roshi was also a ceramist, a potter, you could say. And he was he was quite accomplished in making Japanese style ceramics. In fact, you know, he would get up at like 3 a.m. and start throwing pots. And he would throw pots until 5:30, and we would come. Sometimes we'd come into the Zendo, and he was down in the basement. He had a wheel, and he was glazing and throwing pots or putting glaze on things and getting them into the kiln. And we'd say, Genki, you know, it's time to sit. And he'd take off his potter's jacket, which was covered with clay, and he'd put on his robes, and he'd come upstairs, and he'd sit down and wouldn't move for an hour and a half. So one of the things Genki did was to give all of us a teacup that he had made himself. And he was a true artist. His tea bowls are really worth a lot of money now. And they would have some shows of his ceramics at the University of Washington and at the Henry Gallery. And they would be very well attended, you know. So people took him seriously. He was a real artist, and he gave each of us a teacup that we were supposed to drink our tea out of in the morning. So, you know, just as we at Sesshin have a teacup and we hold it up and somebody pours tea into it, that's what happened at the Zen Center. But anyway, I took my teacup home. I think I wanted to show somebody the teacup. And at any rate, I dropped the teacup and it broke. And this was so mortifying to me because, you know, here was a gift given to me by my teacher that he had made with his own hands. You know, this is how I thought about it. And it was special. It was like, this is for you from my teacher. He gave me this. This is your cup. I made this for you. And I dropped it. And, you know, a psychotherapist could tell you why I was so anxious about this, right? But it was like, if he sees that I broke my cup, he'll see who I really am, kind of how I'm thinking, right? So anyway, Genki, I went around to ceramics places in Seattle. I kept saying to Genki, oh, I forgot my cup. He'd say, where's your cup? I'd say, I forgot my cup. He'd give me a, you know, standard issue teacup. And he would ask me several times, like, where's that cup I gave you? And it was like, oh my God, you know. So anyway, I went to tea places. I went to ceramics places in town. Seattle's a big arts town, so there was a lot of places. And I would take this cup and I'd say, is there any way to repair this cup? And people would laugh and say, no, there's no way to repair it. Glue won't work. Forget about it. Get another cup. And it was like, I can't get another cup. So, you know, basically, I had to finally say to my teacher, I dropped the cup, you know, I dropped the cup. And it was so difficult for me, you know, because it was like saying to him, I'm not the person, even though this sounds might sound strange, I was saying to him, I'm not the person you think I am, right? I broke this precious gift that you gave me because I wasn't mindful. I was probably screwing around in some. I didn't say that to him. And when I told him, I dropped the cup, and he said, oh, I'll get you another cup. And he went downstairs and got me another cup. But it was very difficult for me emotionally to open up with him. And later, actually, during a Dokusan, Genki Roshi actually said to me, you know, you don't share with me, right? He said, put it like that. You don't share with me, you know. And I realized, you know, I'm not being honest with him. I'm afraid to let him see who I really am. Because I thought of myself as like a bad, I'm a pretty bad person, you know, not a very good person. You know, and I think this is, even though this might just be, you know, like me, I think we all do this, right? We all kind of like try to construct a self, right, that has integrity. Right, that's admirable and admirable and worthy of affection and so on, and I think we all feel like underneath that veneer, that shell, right? There's something kind of ugly in there, not nice, not lovable or good or enlightened or whatever, and. And I was afraid, really, of, like everybody, you know, I worked so hard to maintain that shell, right? I was such a good boy when I was around Genki Roshi. And that wasn't necessarily a bad thing. I wanted to be a better person. I wanted to be a different person. I wanted to be awake, right? And so, you know, it wasn't just a sham. It was an expression of what I really wanted to become. But I couldn't, you know, I couldn't deal with what was inside. You know, I was like holding in all this stuff. And when I broke that cup, you know, it was just like everything I was, I felt like was put at risk. And then a little later, you know, unrelated, we were in Dokusan and Genki said, you know, you don't share with me. In other words, you don't let me see. You don't let me see. So a little bit later, actually, I was reading something about another Zen teacher named Maizumi Roshi. And Maizumi Roshi, actually, it was a lecture he gave, and it was about a broken cup. And Maizumi Roshi in his lecture said, you know, the broken cup is the best cup. You know, he said the broken cup is the best cup. It's not the defective cup, it's the best cup. And he meant, I think, you know, those moments where we sort of crack, right? We crack. We get a glimpse of, we can get a glimpse of who and what we really are, right? Who and what we really are. And, you know, we fight it. You know, we want to have everything under control. We want to have everything look good, you know. And that's not a bad thing. We're human, right? That's part of what it means to have a self we have to have a self. We create this self. But, you know, when it cracks open, you know, Rumi says the light comes out. Now, how is that possible? See? And because... you know, that isn't what happened to Humpty Dumpty. You know, Humpty Dumpty falls off the wall and he breaks into 1,000 pieces and he can't be put back together again. The end, right? You know, but actually, it's not like the Humpty Dumpty story. You know, we create this self and we're struggling all the time to maintain its integrity. And we're terrified. I mean, maybe I'm just talking here in the first person and nobody else is like this, but I suspect a lot of people are like this. You know, we're terrified of looking in there ourselves, and we're definitely afraid of letting other people look in there, right? And I think that's very typically human, right? But the thing is, you know, we believe that inside of the self, there's a monster, right? There's like a monster. And we remember all of these times where, you know, we did bad things, right? We did bad things. I mean, I can remember doing many bad things. When I was a kid, my brother and I once spent an afternoon burning insects up with a magnifying glass, for example. You know, and I very much regret that. That was a really bad thing to do. And I've done much worse things than that, you know. So, you know, I definitely didn't want Genki Roshi to see that. But when, you know, I couldn't, you know, when I started allowing myself to crack a little bit, you know, I discovered that inside, so to speak, there isn't a monster. There isn't a monster. You know, there's like the light. The light is in there, you know. And so what Rumi is saying is, you know, don't be afraid of the cracks in your life, of cracking, you know. The problem is that we don't crack enough, really, you know. You know, the function of Zen practice, you could say, is to crack us open, right? So, you know, usually when people are working on some kind of a koan, you know, they're actually, one way to think about it is they're fighting for the integrity of the self they think they have, right? You know, so, you know, we want to preserve a kind of image of ourselves as in control or good or whatever. And, you know, usually koan training puts that at risk in some way. You know, puts that image at risk in some way. And it's sort of saying, let's look beyond the surface, right? And the way koan training does that is to put you in a contradiction where you don't know what answer you should give anymore, right? I mean, all of our lives we're giving the right answer. We're giving the answer mom and dad wanted us to give, or you know, we regret the times where we gave the wrong answer and had to be punished by mom or dad, right? So, you know, we're always trying to give the right answer in life and be the good son or the good daughter or the good father or the good, you know, husband or the good wife and so on. But actually, you know, that's not how people wake up. That's not how people wake up. And the more we cling to those, the more we cling to the Humpty Dumpty view of ourselves, the tighter and more confining our identities become. And so, you know, what we need to do instead is to experience the bliss of cracking open, right? And what happens when you crack open is that you don't find a monster inside. You know, this incredible, radiant Buddha nature comes out so often. And if I may say so, I've seen this again and again at Sesshin. You know, so somebody will come to Sesshin and, you know, basically they'll come into Dokusan and I'll give them a koan. And, you know, sometimes they'll just be inert, right? You know, I'll give them a koan and they come in and what's happening on the cushion? Nothing. And then, you know, sometimes people get angry or people lash out at me. You know, actually, this is quite common. You know, people, nobody's hit me or anything, but, you know, I've gotten people, they sort of poke me or try to get me to get angry at them. They're sort of, you know, defending themselves from me, really, you know. And then, you know, at some point, people break open. It's like day three or four of sesshin, people crack. They crack. And it's like they can't maintain their defenses anymore. And, you know, they're fighting for dear life because they think a monster is going to come out. And then, you know, day three or four of sesshin, people come in and they're absolutely like Buddhas, right? You know, people come in and they cry. You know, some, you know, people say, you know, when I was 12, I lost my brother. You know, I loved my brother so much. I have never trusted life after that, right? And, you know, they're so full of love. It's like so underneath that inert dead veneer or under that cynical anger, there's this, you know, this beautiful Buddha nature. I remember, years ago, my brother, who has passed away, my brother, you know, like so many people, developed a habit of defending himself from the world through caustic humor and sarcasm. And my brother wasn't a Zen practitioner, but he had like a wicked sense of humor. My brother would have you in stitches, and his humor was sort of like stand-up comedy. It was kind of like, if you know, what was his name? Jack Black, Louis Black. I love Louis Black. He reminds me of my brother, but it's angry, sarcastic humor, you know, and my brother was like, but, you know, my brother was a very difficult person to live with, and he eventually had a crisis in his relationship. And his wife slept with somebody else, and it was devastating. He went into a personal crisis, and the thing was, you know, he was melting down. He was in 1,000 pieces. And when I went to see him, he had become somebody he hadn't been for 25 years, right? He was my little brother. He was this loving, kind person. You know, it was astonishing what it had. It was like he cracked open and the Buddha came out, right? And, you know, my brother recovered from his, I'm sorry to say, you know, my brother kind of recovered from his crisis and returned to his old wisecracking self. But for a little while, it was like I saw the Buddha inside my brother. And I guess he didn't have a practice, right? He didn't have a way of keeping open. And in fact, you know, it takes a long time to develop that openness, you know, to trust life enough to develop that willingness to be broken open again and again. And my brother unfortunately didn't do that. But you know, we Zen people go through that process again and again. That's what it's really about. And every time we crack a little bit and the light comes out, you know, it's a little closer to this deep personal transformation. Of course, Rumi actually says, when you crack, it lets the light in. See, actually, just to go back to Rumi for a minute, you know, Rumi says that when you break open, it lets the light in. So Rumi says, you know, basically we're cut off from the light. And when we crack open, it can penetrate. Which, you know, the Buddhist view is the other way around. You know, we're fundamentally Buddha. And so we don't need to crack open to let it in. We need to crack open to let it out. I think that's a much better place to be, as a matter of fact. So, you know, one of the things that happens if you follow this path is you become, you know, you'll read about fearlessness in Buddhism. You think that would be nice. But fearlessness doesn't mean that, if somebody's coming after you in the street, you should definitely turn around and run away, please. And don't fight, run, you know. But fearlessness means you're not afraid of cracking open. See, You could say following the Buddha's path is the path of allowing yourself to break open. And when that happens in real life, you know, nobody wants to have a crisis. Nobody wants to have a situation where maybe your marriage is falling apart. That's next to getting cancer or having a loved one die, that's the worst thing that can happen, right? Nobody wants that to happen. But, you know, everything is helping you to wake up. Everything is helping you to wake up. Everything is helping you to wake up, right? So, you know, when something like that happens, when you get pink slipped, or you have a car accident, right? And you have to spend 6 months in physical therapy. You know, it shakes your confidence in life. It shakes your confidence in yourself, especially if, you know, you caused the accident, right? But, you know, you sit down on the cushion and you go into deep wuxing. And gradually, you know, you respond to this crisis in a different way from the way normally people do, which is trying to close up the wound. And you allow yourself to be open in the presence of this crisis. And the crisis transforms itself into something else, this wonderful opportunity to experience life more deeply. You know, so the sword that cuts the hair is whatever cracks us open in life, really. It's it's whatever in life causes us to fall into a kind of crisis. When that happens, you know, we naturally want to close up again. We naturally want to recoil or make things right. But that's a misunderstanding of who we are. You know, if you think about it, human beings are not like an egg, right? They're not like an egg. Human beings are actually, from the Buddhist standpoint, we would say an energy system. Humans are actually, it sounds very abstract, but Buddhism actually uses the word energy system. Human beings are like an ecology. Yourself is like a system, or like a living system, like an ecology, or a self-organizing complex system. And it's changing all the time. And the problem is that we create these habits that prevent us from developing, right? So, if I'm constantly having arguments at home, one way I can deal with that problem is to just stay at work longer and longer, work more and more hours, right? And instead of solving my problem, I'm controlling my situation by working more and more hours. Or if I have a stress problem, I can come home and basically drink every night to relieve my stress. I'm creating an obstacle to the development of my own ecosystem, right? So everything can be integrated into that system, everything that happens. And when you integrate it, you come to life in a bigger way. It's like every shock to the system is an opportunity to like be a bigger person. And it's natural to want to recoil, but what Zen practice is all about is learning how to cope with these injuries or these crises in a radically different way. Instead of trying to protect your integrity, you let it go. You let it go, and you trust your complex self to integrate all of this into your life. And there's a part of us that doesn't want to do that, but if you do it, you come out on the other end like vastly more vital and alive person. So I want to say something about the second part of this koan. The first part of the koan is a monk asked Haryo, what is the sword against which a hair is blown. So, you know, in other words, what is the sword that liberates us? What is the sword that liberates us? And the sword that liberates us is the crack that lets the light out, basically. So every time something goes wrong for you, you know, you need to remind yourself, everything is helping me wake up. Everything is helping me wake up. And if you don't pull back, but you become one with what is happening, that's allowing your natural ecosystem to operate properly, right? So everything becomes part of this living ecosystem that we call the self, right? This energy system. So everything that happens that's unwelcome or challenging is an opportunity to remove a barrier and like let the energy flow freely, So, but the question is, how do we do this? How do we do this? It's easy to say, how do you do it? See, and actually, the second part of this koan is a mantra, believe it or not. So a monk asked Tarya, what is the sword against which a hair is blown? So that's the crisis, the thing that breaks you open. So the question is, how do you integrate? Tarya said, each branch of the corals embraces the bright moon. So this is actually a mantra you're supposed to recite. Each branch of the corals embraces the bright moon. Each branch of the corals embraces the bright moon. Each branch of the corals embraces the bright moon. Each branch of the corals embraces the bright moon. So it's like reciting a mantra. Now, you may not know this, but, you know, in the Zen world, especially in the United States, but also in the Zen world in Japan, you know, we don't do much with devotional practices, so-called, right? So, you know, when we Zen people think about practice, we think of sitting on the cushion, straightening the back, breathing through the dantian, and we think of koan practice and so on. But, you know, millions of Buddhists in the world don't do that. They do something called nyenfo, which is like sutra recitation, only not the way we do it. They do it like taking a line from the Lotus Sutra or a line from another sutra and just reciting it repetitively, right? That's their practice. And when they do this, they empty themselves out. Right, they empty themselves out just a little bit like Zen practice. Right, so you know, you just keep saying, each branch of the coral embraces the bright moon, or you could say, Namu Dai Bo Sa, Namu Dai Bo Sa, Namu Dai Bo Sa, Namu Dai Bo Sa. See, and you descend into deep samadhi. Right, this deep samadhi, all your thoughts disappear, and you make yourself a conduit, you could say, for this energy that is really you. You know, people aren't an egg. People are like a whirlpool in the water. You know, if you're looking in the water, you see the water suddenly form a whirlpool, and it whirls and it whirls and it whirls, and it gathers energy, right? That's a self. That's a human being. We are like a little whirlpool in the water. That's who we really are. And that's what we really are. And, you know, when we're not flowing freely, the solution is to enter into deep samadhi. Namu Dai Bo Sa. Namu Dai Bo Sa. And what happens is that when you dissolve your, when you stop grasping, when you put to sleep your grasping mind, you begin to feel the energy flowing through your system, surging through your system. And we do the same thing in Zen practice when we do mu, right? People learn to call mu until their minds are completely blank, right? You call mu silently, and then you're supposed to come into the teacher and call moo out loud, right? Moo. And the teacher is actually listening to hear whether you're unable to let that energy flow freely. That's absolutely the truth. It's not about calling loudly. It's about letting becoming one with the energy which you really are. See? And, you know, eventually people are able to empty themselves out and allow that energy to flow freely, right? And when they come into the Zendo, sometimes it's like, you know, it's this torrent of energy. And you can't make that energy happen. You have to trust the process. You have to empty yourself out and be willing to be cracked open and let that energy out. See? Well, in this case, what the koan is talking about is a kind of nyenfo practice where you say those lines from the koan, or you could say something like Namu Dai Bo Sa, Namu Dai Bo Sa. And you know, if you do it for a while, you begin to feel this tremendous energy being released. And that energy is who and what you really are, you know. So you know, a lot of people go through their lives feeling exhausted and tired and fearful and so on. But you know, that's actually caused by the habit of clinging, or the habit of keeping the lid on yourself, so to speak. You know, so when I saw Genki coming down the street, and I was so frightened that he would see who I really was that I ducked into a store. And then later, when I would see Genki Roshi, I would always be on my best behavior to have a nice smile on my face and look placid and so on. You know, that's actually exhausting. And we do that all the time to ourselves. We're constantly trying to keep what's inside from coming out. And it's incredibly enervating, right? So you know, when you begin to learn how to quiet the mind and empty yourself out, the energy begins to flow freely. This is the idea. You know, this morning I'll wrap this up. This morning we recited the koans, right? I mean, the sutras. And, you know, we aren't able to recite together, but actually in a certain way, this is even better, right? Because, you know, when Keith is reciting the sutra and nobody else can hear you, you can really let it out. You know, you really should try it. If you're a little bit embarrassed, you know, nobody can hear you now, right? So, you know, actually, you know, if you start reciting the sutras as a way of emptying your mind and letting the energy out, you will find, I promise you, that the energy begins to magnify. It begins to grow and grow. Just try it. You know, when I was I'm sure this has happened to you, maybe it hasn't happened to you, but do you remember your first swear words? Do you remember the first swear words you said? Right, swear words are so interesting, right? Because you know, when you're growing up, your parents say absolutely don't say that, right? And at the same time, you know, you're hearing people say it, but you know, people usually start swearing at a time in their life when they're in transit. You know, they're undergoing a lot of changes, and they don't have language for what they're feeling. You know, so if you were about 12 or 13 when you started swearing, you know, so many things are changing in your life, and you can't let that energy out. You know, I was thinking this morning on the cushion about how to talk about this koan. And I was thinking of the first time I ever said fuck in public was at a grocery store. I was in a grocery store. I was so unhappy. And I was about 12 years old, and I felt I put so much pressure on myself in so many ways. And I was in a grocery store with my friend Mark Miller. And there was an advertisement on the wall. There used to be a cheap encyclopedia you could buy called Funk and Wagnalls World Encyclopedia. And we looked, and I said to my friend Mark, fuck, you know, and everybody looked at me. I was like a 12-year-old, and I just said, fuck. And I felt so liberated. It was just so, I really didn't know what fuck meant, but it just felt so great to say fuck, right? Reciting the sutras is like that, right? It doesn't matter what it means. It's like you're punching a hole open in your shell, right? When you recite, if you recite the sutras, one way to recite the sutras is to say, oh God, here come the sutras. When can we get to the meditation part? See? But, you know, when you use the recitation as an opportunity to open up, like create a conduit for that energy, it becomes incredibly powerful. See, it's a deep practice. Reciting the sutras, you know, as I've said, at some places when people recite the sutras, by the end of the recitation period, people are screaming. And some of it's bullshit, some of it's artificial, but if you try it, you'll begin to feel that energy flowing. And it's not trivial. It's trusting who you really are. There's not a monster in there. There's a Buddha trying to get out. And Buddha is another word for this infinite radiant energy that we really are. You know, when people start practicing Zen, they feel very far from that. They feel it's often very lifeless and very unhappy. But every time you crack open and you let that energy out, you're transformed a little bit more. And it feels good every step of the way. Engo's introduction, we sow the cause and reap the results. Starting carefully, we end in consummate perfection. That's, of course, baloney. From the outset, nothing was kept secret. When I talked, I had nothing to give you. Some of you will say to me, you have talked so long during the summer retreat, and now you said that from the beginning, you had nothing to tell us. What do you mean? I replied that I will tell you when you have obtained realization. Now, I ask you, is this simply because I do not fail to observe the first principle? Or is there some real advantage in doing so? See the following. Main subject. A monk asked Haryo, what is the sword against which a hair is blown, the sharp sword that sets us free? Haryo said, each branch of the corals embraces the bright moon. Namu dai bosa, myoho renge kyo. Myoho renge kyo, myoho renge kyo. Secho's verse. To cut off discontents, rough methods may be best. Now they slap, now they point. The sword glides across the sky. The snow glistens in its light. No one can forge or sharpen it. Myoho renge kyo, myoho renge kyo, myoho renge kyo.